The meeting of the Civil Justice Committee is called to order, and we do have a quorum present. The first item on the calendar is Representative Junkie, House File 8.41. And Representative Junkie, I will move the bill, and this goes to Finance, I believe. And just as an explanation to members, there's only a very small change in the present law, but because it affects foreclosure, it had to come to this committee. And basically, the original bill as introduced would have presented problems, but it's now clearly constitutional within the U.S. Supreme Court decision. And the hearing on justification, Representative Junkie has told me, was already thoroughly discussed in the Ag Committee, and I think there's nobody here that's going to question that we have an emergency situation, that we need it. So hopefully, this committee, this bill had no discussion in the Commerce Committee, and so hopefully there won't be any, but I have to ask if there's any opposition to it. No opposition, okay. Is there any, anybody who wants to talk on it? Hopefully not. Okay, all in favor of Representative Junkie's bill, which to a pass, and we referred to Finance. Do you want to speak on it, Representative Junkie? I think you want to just get out of here. Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carry. Thank you,
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair, member.
The next bill is that Kahn's. Representative Kahn. It's in a stem cell or something. Representative Kahn, Representative Mahoney, do you want to move the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 655, but I'm not sure where it needs to go.
Representative Mahoney, to the General Register.
To the General Register, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Mahoney, and Representative Kahn, go ahead and present your bill.
Yes. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this bill is a very small attempt to cut down some of the costs of government that we can incur. It refers to what I thought was a highly unusual situation, and I think the only unusual part of it was the intransigence of my opponent. What happened, this happened in the election in 6002, and I have a whole file of papers that it ended up in the Supreme Court in terms of doing it, where the person filed for election against me filed with an address listed on the form that was not in the district. And since you're nowhere required to state your residence on the forms that you file, we didn't pay it. I knew right away when I looked at it that it wasn't in the district, but I figured he was using his campaign manager's address or something as his general address. So at some point late in the campaign, in about September, we found out that he wasn't constitutionally eligible to serve because he wasn't living in the district, so we tried to just tell Hennepin County to take him off the ballot. And they first said yes, and then someone objected, and so then they said no, that the county auditor doesn't have the ability to do this, only by a court order can he come off the ballot. He really thought that this guy should not be on the ballot, and I recall I actually asked the DFL caucus to pay for the court expenses. In response from one of the staff people, they quoted a famous quote from Representative Jim Rice about the lottery, was that your chance of winning the lottery was about as good whether you bought a ticket or not. And their thought about this person was his chance of winning was about as good whether he was on the ballot or not. So the DFL had no interest in taking him off the ballot. So we went ahead and did it anyway. We had complicated.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn.
Yes.
There's a lot of bills on the table today. I'd like to vote for your bill, and I'd like to do it fairly quickly.
Okay. The only reason this bill is before you is because in the course of taking the bill through the process, the question was allowing a candidate now has to put their name, has to put their resident on the form, and there are some people who might like to keep it secret. The first place is the first people who are excluded are the people who always do it secret, all the people who are involved in law enforcement, like judges, county sheriffs, county attorneys, and so forth, never put their home address on the ballot. Then, though, the question came up about what about some legislators don't, and this specifically came up that for various reasons want to keep their home address private. So you then have to, and it doesn't really change, the reason that the bill changes it is that you're no longer able to do it private unless we allow them to do an affidavit, so we end up having to allow them to do it classified as private data under 13.02, so that's in 2.6 and 2.7 in the bill. So that's the reason why it was sent to this committee.
Representative,
because it's another private data.
Thank you, Chair Mallory. Representative Kahn, aren't we required to list our home addresses at campaign finance?
No.
Representative Kahn, Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Kahn, those forms that we fill out, the information is voluntary and...
Yes.
Representative Kahn.
Jim.
Representative Holbert.
And Mr. Chair, do you, Representative Kahn, do you see a need to have the address of the contact be in the district, the alternative contract? Or you don't care where in the state of Minnesota or where in the country it is, or...
Well,
Representative Kahn.
I think anyone who's seriously running for office probably wants to have some contact, and I think most people put their residence address or some place where they can be. I don't think that there's any need to require that by law. I don't think there are. You know, as I said, it was always could be kept private because you didn't have to list it. Well, you could list anything you wanted. You could put a P.O. box, or you could put your campaign manager's address or any place that you wanted information to go to. Now, requiring it to be available and to be available where someone at least can look at it means that you then also have to do the separate step of making it able to be kept private. It's always, we're not really changing. Well, what we're changing is that we're changing the fact that you have to take a step to keep it private instead of just not give it.
Representative Fulver? No? Okay. Representative Jackson?
Interestingly, in my school district, we had an election, and it was only after somebody was elected to the school board that it was discovered this person didn't live in the district. And what you're talking about would have prevented that, because instead it meant, you know, a process to replace somebody, and it was really unfortunate.
Well, Representative Kahn, I'm just wondering who, if it's private data, who can track down to see the filing officer? They may not have a lot of incentive to go to great depth. I remember, and the reason I remember this is the person who ran against me, I believe. I know he was in the primary. He ran in two cities and voted in two cities the same election.
But we're more alert. We got us run off.
I'm just wondering.
On lines 211, if requested, from 2.8 on, section D, that says that any registered voter can request in writing that the filing officer review the address. So the address has to be provided. It's somewhere. I don't know where they keep private data. It's kept, and if anyone requests, I would think that anyone seeing that there was not an address, that there was not a residential address on the form, a sensible thing to do would be to request that the filing officer look and see if the person does, if the address is, if that address is eligible to be elected to the office.
Well, Representative Conn, my only question was, I guess my, maybe I didn't make it clear. My question was how to, let's say that you had an opponent and you thought he was not really living in your district. You could request this, but will the filing officer have much incentive to really track down where that person is living as compared to some of your active campaign workers?
Mr. Chairman, always said they don't have to do that. Or this is only deals. It doesn't deal with someone putting an address down and not living there. That's a totally separate. This only deals with the question where a person puts an address down that shows that they're constitutionally ineligible for the office, well, statutorily, whatever it is. This case was constitutionally ineligible, and you can't take them off the ballot except by going to court.
Representative Drostowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Conn, can you tell us again what exactly the reason is for this bill? I'm confused.
Well,
Representative Conn?
The reason is when you have something that's completely simple, and I can give you all the court filings on it if you want, which is completely simple. The person by the Minnesota Constitution is admitting that he's not living in the district. The person by the Minnesota Constitution is not eligible to run for office in this case, and you can't take him off the ballot except going to the Supreme Court. So that just seems silly.
Okay, I guess there's no further discussion. The motion was to pass and send it to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries. Thank you, Representative Conn.
Thank you very much.
Representative Hillstrom, I believe 892.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 892 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to finance with the recommendation that it go to public safety finance.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have been working on TIPS for about the last 8 years, TIPS cases, and most of you probably saw that last year the public defender stopped representing parents in the TIPS cases. During the last biennium, we had been working on a compromise to see if we couldn't figure out who was going to pay for TIPS representation. And this was the compromise that made it all the way to conference committee. Now, since this compromise was proposed, as you know, the public defender stopped representing parents, and I think that this is something that we need to be talking about. I believe someone is here from the courts that can speak about the impact that that has had on the courts as well, but with me are the folks that were working on it in the past, and I hope members would consider this policy and then let us send it on to finance where representatives Paymar can help deal with the money issues.
And Representative Hillstrom, I see you have two witnesses who are around here a lot. Do you want to introduce them?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to have them introduce themselves. I'm not sure who wants to go first, so if they could introduce themselves and talk about the bill, that would be great.
Mr. Chair, I'm Phyllis Brumfield. I'm the Deputy Director of Community Services in Scott County, and I'm here today representing MICA as well as the county perspective on this issue. Just to give you a very brief background, this is something that has been recognized for a number of years as an issue. CHIPS cases, children in need of protection or services, are a part of the child welfare, child protection system, and it's been an unresolved issue in front of this legislature for 8 or more years. It was recognized by the legislature in 2005 as a significant issue, and the legislature at that point required that there be a work group to report back to the legislature on a resolution for the limited funding that would occur the next year. I was a part of that work group. It was also recognized by the Minnesota Judicial Council this past year, which formed another work group and made another report, I believe, back to the legislature. I also served on that work group. Both work groups have emphasized the need for a consistent statewide system to provide parental representation in CHIPS cases. This last July, the Board of Public Defense realized that they could no longer afford to provide all the services they were providing, and at that point made a decision to no longer provide representation to parents in the CHIPS cases. This resulted in total chaos in what had previously been a marginally functional system. Beginning then in July, most counties stepped up and began funding some portion of representation for parents. But there were a number of consequences immediately felt. There were delayed hearings. There were parents responding to petitions in court without representation. There was inconsistency between judicial districts in how they appointed representation, and even inconsistency within a single county among the judges within that county with how they appointed representation. We also dismantled a very critical component of the Children's Justice Initiative, which is something that Minnesota is duly proud of and has been a model for the nation. What I want to talk about just briefly this evening is, more importantly, the consequences of our failure to act upon this issue at this point in time. The importance of this is that when a petition for CHIPS is initiated within the county court system, it results in the removal, often, of children into foster care, and ultimately can result in the termination of parental rights. When you look at the consequences to individuals, a termination of parental rights is, in essence, a death sentence for an entire family. A first-degree murder conviction can only result in either a number of years in prison, ultimately life in prison. But we have a death sentence for families with a termination of parental rights. It is unconscionable that we would do that without the parents having any kind of representation. At a national level, the Federal Child Abuse and Prevention Treatment Act of 1974, the Adoption Assistance and Child Welfare Act of 1997, and the Adoption and Safe Family Act of 1997 mandates that the child protection system seek to protect abused and neglected children, provide services to them and to their families, and establish permanent, safe, nurturing homes for them in a timely fashion. The child protection system that's in all of these statutes includes all of the court system involved in CHIPS cases. And the CPI initiative is providing safe, permanent homes for children within a time frame that meets the child's developmental and emotional needs. That means it's a very short time frame. Parents have 1 year to be reunified with their children before the county needs to move forward with a permanency petition. Parents must be represented, or else there are unconscionable delays in these timelines, and that affects children's ability to survive. The current status in Minnesota with the decision of the public defender to no longer provide representation is that we have 84 different systems of parental representation. County boards have different options for payment and resources that they can commit to this issue. The quality of representation also varies greatly across Minnesota. This is a very specialized area of the law. There are, in 2007, about 9,000 children in out-of-home placement. Of those, many were involved in the CHIPS system. Some counties had 2,000 children in placement. Other counties had 3 children. If an attorney only has the experience in court 3 times during a year, they hardly develop the expertise for this very complicated area of law. Finally, most importantly, children will be hurt. Research tells us that children who do not have their permanency needs met, who are subject to abuse and neglect, and are not able to move into permanent homes, are not able to develop emotionally, intellectually, and physically as they should. We can certainly look at our jail system, our prison system, our welfare system to know that these children do not thrive if we don't meet their needs. There certainly are a number of services that I would say are best defined and provided at the local county level. This is not one of them. This is a state service. It needs to be the state's responsibility. And we need to figure out a way to assure that children receive the services they need in any county they happen to live, as opposed to having the representation they need if the county can happen to afford it. Thank you.
Mr. Tilmer,
You also going to speak on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members, I just wanted to, my name is John Tuma, by the way. I'm with the Minnesota Inter-County Association. I do their public safety and corrections lobbying. We represent 13 of Minnesota's fastest growing counties in the state. We support our Representative Hillstrom putting this, what we thought was a fair compromise 2 years ago, back on the table for discussion. We understand the world has changed significantly in this area with the public defender's decision back in July not to represent adults in child protection cases anymore, and it has put significant strain on county budgets. Addressing this really in an emergency situation, they didn't have the ability to raise the tax or a fee really quick to cover this. But on July of this last year, they were forced to respond to this, and they have responded. And a lot of the responses were on a temporary basis, and there is litigation around what should happen in this area, and we know that. What we're here, though, is to try to offer a fair compromise back on the table to help solve this problem. We know this is a dollar question, and those will be addressed at the next level. But we think this framework, this policy framework of how this works, is a good starting point to work from. It was worked out with the work with county attorneys, with public defenders, with county social service folks, with several other individuals, the clerks were involved in this discussion to build this policy framework. So we want you to know that you don't have to start from ground zero. There is a policy framework to be put in place, and we appreciate Representative Hillstrom's willingness to continue to drive forward this compromise language. I want to just quickly run through the elements of this bill. It is very simple. Sections 1, 2, and 3, and the last parts of Section 4 essentially say that public defenders will represent adults, the custodial parents, and the guardians in child protection cases, and they will pay for it. So the state funding that you provide the public defenders would cover the representation of adults in child protection cases. This was the case in most jurisdictions throughout the state. Granted, our system was kind of a mixed bag when the state took over the public defender system back in the early 1990s, but what we're saying here is very clearly defining that the child protection cases, the adult parents, and the guardians will be paid for and represented by public defenders. The non-custodial parents will be represented by public defenders, but the county will reimburse the public defenders at $60 an hour for that representation. Kind of a shared responsibility, again, recognizing that this is a hybrid system that was really taken over back in the 1990s. The courts under sections 4 and 5 would not have authority to make appointments in child protection cases beyond the parents, both custodial and non-custodial, and that under sections 4 and 5 also that the public defenders would not be obligated to represent anybody beyond their existing four classes of representation under 611.14 and 611.16. So in other words, public defenders could not be appointed by courts for anything outside of representing criminals on appeal, representing probation, violation revocations, and juveniles ages 10 through 18. And so we clearly create a limitation on the class of individuals courts can appoint. There have been problems where courts have appointed outside of those classes, and we're saying, you know, there's some constitutional obligations here. Let's have the representation there. But outside of that, courts, we have a difficult problem meeting these things, and we want to limit the representation. And so this was a fair compromise 2 years ago, we felt. It was a good framework to work from. And again, we think it makes sense to start working from this framework as we go forward into answering the question, how to pay. And so we appreciate, again, Representative Hillstrom bringing this bill forward. We think it's a fair basis to begin this discussion from in 2009. And appreciate your time, Mr. Chairman.
I believe Mr. Stewart wants to speak on this bill. Mr. Stewart, you can just state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is John Stewart. I'm the Minnesota State Public Defender. I'm here to express some concerns, of which I think the biggest one would be obvious to the committee, which is that the Board of Public Defense has been trying to get state funding to provide this service since 1994, and we haven't been able to do it. And this doesn't look like a very good year to say, well, now's the year you might get money to do this. In 1994, you appropriately and graciously appropriated $5.3 million for lawyers for juvenile court to the Board of Public Defense, and it was line item vetoed. And the public defense juvenile court component has never really recovered from that veto. So that's my concern. I don't necessarily disagree, and the Board of Public Defense doesn't necessarily disagree with the framework here as it's presented in the abstract. It's that next step of finding a whole lot of money that has me concerned. I would respectfully disagree with Mr. Tuma that the representation of parents was taken over by the board in the 1990s. The board took over the representation of children in juvenile court, as is reflected in the current law and the law that's been current pretty much since juvenile court started, that the child has a right to a lawyer. And that's because it's almost like delinquency in the sense that the child's liberty interest is involved. It's the child that may be sent to a treatment program or a new home or some other kind of out-of-home placement. So as the board represents the children in delinquency, they have always represented the children in these cases pursuant to law. The parents, it's been up in the air who's been supposed to do that, but there's no authority that says that the state Board of Public Defense should do that. Should it? Well, you know, there's some features considered in the abstract that make it very appealing, but as I say, it's been impossible to get the funding. We worked with Chief Justice Blass for 3 years to try to get the funding back from 2001, 2002, 2003. Some of you here remember that. We came back in 2005, 2006, 2007, and I'm not blaming anybody, but the circumstances were such that this very important service could never be funded. I should say I myself was a CHIPS parents lawyer for 10 years. I've worked on 4 of these studies that have been talked about today. I was on the study commission with Ms. Brumfield in 2006, and that committee concluded that the Board of Public Defense should do this if it got $9 million. But instead of getting the $9 million, unfortunately, circumstances were such that the board got cut and we lost 12% of our attorneys. So that's why we're sitting here like this, and that's my big concern. Now, I want to just mention 2 small concerns that are kind of in the fine print in the bill. One of them is the $60 an hour. That's a figure that goes to some discussions that go way back. I should say, looking at the most recent report that the Public Safety Committee got a month ago from the Judicial Council, I see that there are 29 counties that are paying $75 an hour. There's 2 that are paying $80 an hour. There's 1 that's paying $50 an hour. There's 5 more counties paying $85 an hour, and there's 6 counties paying $100. So I think we're not going to be able to get this done in a lot of counties at $60 an hour anymore. Maybe that was a good figure when this first started to be talked about, but that would be a problem for a lot of counties to even find people who would do this technical and complex and important and emotionally very grueling and stressful type of work. Basically, if you're a parent's lawyer and you're dealing with allegations of child abuse and neglect and maltreatment day in and day out. So it's not an easy job, and it's not easy to get people to do it for $60 an hour. I also would question the part that's set up for the Board of Public Defense to do all the administrative support work for this. And that's, you know, again, it's a good idea, but we've got all of our managers now having huge caseloads because of the unfortunate cuts that had to take place last year. So I'm nervous about this whole thing. I think the author's done a terrific job of bringing this forward and giving you a policy platform that is one very viable alternative. But I'm mighty nervous about it. You know, we've got a chance to talk about this. We're mighty nervous about having to take back a very, very difficult situation at the time when the state is in the worst financial position that I can ever remember.
Thank you. Is there any other opposition? Okay, Representative Portman.
Mr. Chair, I say I'm concerned. I'm not. I'm not opposed, but I'm sure concerned.
Mr. Stewart, I think you'll, I'm sure, appear in Representative Tamar's Finance Committee.
You betcha. Thank you.
Representative Portman.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure to which person my question is directed, but having this statute in front of us brings to mind a concern raised to me by the Anoka County attorney that we have made, in some cases, court cases more complicated than they need to be, and thereby increasing expenses and increasing the burden on county's attorneys and other parts of our court system. And one specific issue he raised was, for example, in a CHIPS case, where you would have an attorney for the child, sometimes an attorney for the parent, and you have an attorney representing the state, and then you also have a guardian ad litem. So I'm asking you a sort of an ancillary issue question that your bill raises because of the people who testified here. Your perspective on, is the guardian ad litem needed in that situation, or is this perhaps a place where we have made the courts more complicated than they need to be?
And then maybe more expensive. Why do you have a guardian ad litem and the with an attorney and the child with an attorney? Are they not pretty similar interests?
I wonder if it's more to the witnesses than the Representative Hilton.
Do you want to indicate?
If I could take that one, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Hilton.
Representative Portman, this bill doesn't deal with the guardian ad litem for the child. This deals with the parents. And I have some differing opinions on whether or not guardian ad litems may or may not be needed for the child when there is a lawyer as well. But that really is outside of this bill, and I'd be happy to chat with you further or even maybe consider a bill about whether or not what that relationship should look like. But this really gets to whether or not the parents should have an attorney. And previous to this bill, there was discussion about whether or not they should take away the legal representation of the children and give it to the parents. And I have consistently opposed that. And so I have the entire time said that while I would oppose taking away the child's lawyer, I then would advocate on behalf of bills such as this to make sure that the parents have an attorney. Because when the parents don't have an attorney, it does make the cases go longer. It makes it more complicated. Many of the parents don't understand what's happening with the process. And the prediction was that you would see children in out-of-home placement longer and that the court cases would take longer, and I don't know if that has come to fruition or not, but I really think that if we want parents to have the opportunity to keep their children, they need to be adequately represented, and that's what I'm attempting to do here.
And then the Portman, any further?
Well, I'll just chat with your witnesses afterwards because I think they're uniquely qualified to comment on this issue that was raised for me by the county attorney in Anoka County, recognizing our budget situation and maybe looking at that as a place. Maybe we need another bill.
Okay. Representative Holmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom. Are these parents, the representation for these parents means tested? In other words, do they have to have a certain income threshold in order to qualify, or do you give them to every parent?
Mr. Chair, and I'll let John, too, respond to this. The answer is essentially yes. They're supposed to be able to qualify for public defender under this system, and so you don't get an attorney if you have the means to get your own. This is, again, a qualifying under the public defender system. That's why when we created this framework, and it is truly meant to be a framework from a policy standpoint, we thought it would be best just to plug into the existing frame that we set for public defenders for people to qualify. So if you're of means, the courts should not appoint. Does that always happen? No. I mean, there's circumstances where people of means do get attorneys and they have assets that they're not disclosing and things like that. So it's not a perfect system, but it is meant to be means tested.
And Mr. Chair, if any of the witnesses know what income level approximately do you qualify for a public defender?
Mr. Stewart?
If you're a parent in one of these cases.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg,
The most common qualifier is that the household is qualified for federal means-tested benefits, so we're indexed to food stamps, basically. If the family is getting food stamps or some other federal means-tested benefits, that would be the main qualifier. The other qualifier would be that there's an application form that I think is 4 pages that lists income and assets, and the court screens that, and if they determine that the person, based on their income and assets, is unable to pay, then even in a family which isn't receiving food stamps or a similar entitlement, then that family might qualify for representation.
And if I might, one other question, you differentiate between non-custodial and custodial parent. If the child has already been removed and is in foster care, are both parents considered non-custodial, or does this terminology go back only to divorce proceedings?
Opposition Chair and Representative Holbrook, the intent was that if they're still the custodial parent and they have not had their permanently terminated their parental rights, they're still considered the custodial parent. And so it would be on be upon the termination of permanency of the child being taken away from that family that they would no longer be the quote-unquote custodial parent in that situation. It really does go back to the divorce proceedings. Or no other proceedings. Sometimes it's just that the father has lost his parental rights already because he's in prison or whatever the situation might be.
Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm trying to figure out, are we putting a new mandate on, or are we trying to find a way to pay for an old mandate?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, it was a mandate that they stopped doing in July because it wasn't really in law saying they had to do it. And so I actually have another proposal to actually fund the public defenders that's already in Representative Paymar's bill. But I think that this is really, we're trying to figure out how to pay for it and get someone actually representing them again.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
And Representative Hilton, you mentioned the idea the courts came a couple years ago or a few years ago and said that it was going to cost a lot of money and create a lot of trouble and everything, and you still have yet to see that. I think I had a bill a little while ago that argument was used.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. I actually, because this isn't the fiscal committee, haven't asked. So when we get a fiscal note and those kinds of things, maybe I'll be able to talk about that.
Okay. Representative Hilstrom renews her motion to pass House File 892 and send it to the Finance Committee with a recommendation to go to Public Safety Finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Hilstrom, I assume you want to move House File 1397.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. I would move that House
File. This one goes to Public Safety, I believe?
Correct.
Thank you. I see Mr. Thompson coming up.
Mr. Chair, this was brought to me by the Hennepin County District Court, the 4th Judicial District, and so I'd like to turn it over to them to describe the bill, and there isn't a technical amendment.
Representative Hilstrom, just this the 118?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom moves House File, Amendment 118 to get it in the shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead, Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to turn it over to Mark Thompson with the Hennepin County District Court.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thompson.
I'm Mark Thompson, Hennepin County Court Administrator. File 1397 brings into conformity with a previous statute that was established for Ramsey County, where I will read first to you the Ramsey County statute and then explain the Hennepin County file, House File 1397 you have before you. In Ramsey County, existing statutory law is misdemeanor violation bureaus shall be established within those municipalities in which court sessions are conducted, and at such additional places as the majority of the court judges of the court establish. At the current time, the statute that pertains to this issue in Hennepin County, which we hope to have amended with House File 1397, gives specific locations within Hennepin County for us to serve these violation bureaus. specifically Minneapolis, a southern suburban location, and any other northern and western suburban locations dispersed throughout the county as may be designated by a majority of the judges of the district court, of the court. We are reviewing right now our service delivery options in light of fiscal constraints that we've experienced over the last 2 years. In the last 2 years, my budget in Hennepin County District Court has gone down around 4.5% in terms of real employees. That is about 45 employees. We are set and poised to reduce our budget 5 to 7%, depending on which version of a proposed budget from which political subdivision of government we wind up with. Either of those would result in a substantial reduction of current FTEs in the first year and more in the second. In fact, in the second year under either version of those budgets, we would wind up eliminating more FTEs in Hennepin County than currently serve in all three suburban locations. A total of about 76. We have 48 employees in the three suburban locations. Each of those suburban locations currently serve around 30 to 35,000 citizens on an annual basis. The smallest of the three locations has more activity than 80 of the county courts in the state of Minnesota.
Well, Mr. Thompson, right off, I agree that there's a total misapplication of funds in this state between court systems when you compare what Hennepin and Ramsey face and some of the inner ring suburbs and what goes on in greater Minnesota. But I wonder about this. First of all, it looks to me like you could even close, with this bill, you could end up closing Minneapolis. But second of all, what costs to local governments are created here?
I'm not sure about the cost to local governments, and I know there is at least one individual, the chief of police from Bloomington, who's here to speak regarding this bill. I can tell you that if a 5 or 7% budget come through for Hennepin County District Court alone, and I can't speak for any other court in the state, only ours, that we would be forced to close at least one suburban location, if not all three. Now, I want to tell you about the savings for closing one suburban location. It's around $200,000 to $300,000 per year, which is 3/4 of 1 percentage point of my budget. If I closed all three suburban locations, we would yield an effective 2% decrease in our budget expenditure. We would also require everyone to drive to downtown Minneapolis. We would have to relocate those cases to downtown Minneapolis. That's about 115,000 cases per year, about 400 people per day that would be driving downtown, along with the accompanying police officers, attorneys, and witnesses, as opposed to being in their regional locations where they're currently located. Fact of the matter is, if we had a 7% budget cut, this would be the least of the offensive things that would probably occur in a Hennepin County District Court. Domestic violence would be cut, our pro se service center would be cut, civil cases would be delayed, conciliation courses might be delayed forever. And so as we do scenario planning, this is just one tool in the toolbox. If we had a moderate cut to the court's budget, it is contemplatable that we would reduce our suburban locations by one. It is not to best serve our citizens to reduce these suburban locations. I think, in fact, it is contrary to that, but I have to have this tool in the toolbox, and in fact, Ramsey County has had this tool in the toolbox for over 20 years.
Thank you. And hopefully the finance will look at the what could be misapplication or not unintentional of money as to what's needed. And I'm just wondering the cost of prosecutors extra time, of police extra time, things like that. But maybe somebody else is going to testify to that. Is there any opposition to this? There was somebody came up and said he was opposed to it.
Mr. Chair, while he comes down, I just would like members to note that no one thinks that any of these options for the budget cutting are great. It is something that we do have to consider, and the majority of people that represent Hennepin County have signed on the bill, both in the House and the Senate.
Jeff Potts, I guess?
Yes, it is.
You're from Bloomington?
Yes, I am, Chair. Jeff Potts, the chief from Bloomington, and I would speak on behalf of Bloomington as well as, I believe, the majority of the Hennepin Suburban Chiefs and the Hennepin Chiefs Association, that the bill, although it doesn't specifically say, we think opens the door to closing some of these district court locations, which would, in our opinion, drastically increase the amount of time officers have to spend on court, and that would, I guess, depend greatly on where they go. If it's downtown, I think it could double their time, depending on the calendars and how that goes, how they're assigned to testify downtown. If they're going from one end of the county to another district, it may be as far away as Minneapolis. I think it depends on how and where they have to go will determine how much longer we have to spend on court. That's the police officer side and the prosecutor side to it. I think we also need to keep in mind that we rely heavily on witnesses to get down to testify. And quite honestly, telling them to go from Bloomington to Southdale is tough sometimes, where they don't have to pay for parking and some of the other issues that go along with it. To get them to go downtown, I think makes it even tougher, a much tougher case for us to get our witnesses, victims, and others to show up at court. So with the number of filings at each one of these being, I think, is bigger, larger than 80, or the 87 counties, from a volume standpoint, it seems like there may be, I'm not sure what they are, other options. It's just the suburban chiefs look at it as an option that opens the door, and we may end up with sending everybody downtown. I'm not sure exactly what the future of this would be, but I think that compounds are already tough court problems that we have.
It's another mandate local governments, but Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, how does the rest of the state do this? And I'm assuming this is language held over from when the courts were not handled by the state. And what would the approach be to just do what the rest of the state does?
Representative Hillstrom.
If I could defer to Mark Thompson. Mr.
Thompson.
There's complementary language in another statute that requires that courts be held, or a courthouse be in every county seat in the state of Minnesota. We meet that requirement times four at the present time. Ramsey does times three. Dakota does times three. And I think Washington has one satellite court facility.
Why don't we just delete this as obsolete, as hanging over from the days in which the courts were not run by the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, did you want to comment?
That would accomplish the same thing. We just were putting it in statute to match Ramsey County's statute.
And Mr. Chair, I'm really happy when we delete language out of law books as opposed to keeping it in. So whether it's just a couple lines, to see it disappear would be really nice.
Okay, it looks like there's no further discussion. Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to pass House File 1397 as amended and send it to public safety. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried. Representative Dabney, are you in the room?
Yes.
I see you. Representative Dabney has House File 549.
Yeah.
Would somebody like to move it? Representative Johnson moves House File 549. Representative Dabney, I see you have witnesses, Mr. Elwood, and I'm not sure. Go ahead and present your bill. And this one has to go to finance, I believe.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's what I told.
We refer then to energy. Is that correct?
What?
Okay, we'll keep talking while you guys figure that out. I'm sure there should be an amendment in members' packets as well. The amendment, members, codifies some progress in negotiations between representatives of the debt settlement industry and advocates for regulation of debt settlers working on House File 549.
Representative Dabney, would that be A3 amendment?
I would need to see a copy because I'm not working with an official.
0549A3 amendment?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, that would be, and thank you to Representative Holberg for having me back
Johnson,
there.
Do you move the amendments in to get in the shape the author wants?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, carries. Boy, that was an energetic aye.
There's nothing like a good conversation, a debt settlement at 5:30 in the evening to get blood flowing. Members, 2 years ago, I came forward with regulation on debt management plans. That legislation came through this committee, went to several other places, and passed off the House floor 130-0, and its companion in the Senate 64-0. At that time, members of the debt settlement industry, a different thing than debt management, came forward relatively late in the process and asked to be regulated under the same statute and language as debt management. At that point, we felt like we didn't know enough of the distinctions between the two industries, how they operate, and what the impact is for consumers to include them in that legislation. I think it's fair to say we are glad that we did not, because they are two different industries with different business models and different approaches and deserve to be regulated separately. Mm-hmm. Currently in Minnesota, we do not regulate debt settlement providers, and I think it is time we do so. Debt settlement providers work with consumers who are in arrears on their debt, but they do so in a very different way. They encourage the consumer not to pay their bills, to instead set money aside, and at some point in the future, after the consumer has collected a sufficient amount of money, the debt settlement provider will then go to the creditor and attempt to negotiate some sort of an agreement between the consumer and the creditor as to what is an acceptable payback for the debt less than what is owed. This has a number of risks for the consumer in terms of the impact on their credit score, possible garnishment of wages, lawsuits, and collection phone calls. Our hope is that by working on House File 549 and putting into state statute language regulating debt settlement providers in Minnesota, we can protect consumers from bluntly some of the less scrupulous members of the debt settlement industry. With me tonight is Mr. Ron Elwood from Legal Services Advocacy Project and Jeff Harrington from the Attorney General's Office.
Thank you, and who is up first?
I'll go first.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Just a quick background on this industry. Just a couple of years ago, there were only about 300 of these outfits operating in the United States, and according to the Federal Trade Commission, today there are over 1,000. And this is an exploding and proliferating proliferating industry, which, as Representative Dabney says, carries very great risks for the debtors who get involved with these outfits. The FTC has taken numerous actions against debt settlers around the country, identified a series of abusive practices. I was at an FTC hearing in September of 2008 at which many of these were unveiled. Representative Dabney did run through many of them. And of course, this industry is unregulated in Minnesota. Just want to briefly tell you what this bill does. Mainly it requires, as we did with debt managers 2 years ago, that these debt settlers register with the Department of Commerce. It requires a written contract for to provide these services. It requires, before the contract can be signed, that the debt settler does some financial analysis of the individual debtor situation and provide some kind of consumer education as opposed to what are the various options, debt settlement being only one. It requires that they determine that this type of intervention is suitable for this consumer. There are a series of disclosures that are required to warn people that while they're in this program, they could be sued, their wages could be garnished, they could get still continue to get collection calls, et cetera, prohibits a number of abusive practices similar to what we did with the debt management, and provides for enforcement. I think with that, I would stand for questions and turn over to my colleague.
Mr. Harrington.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the committee. My name is Jeff Harrington. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. Thank you for conducting this important hearing on this pressing issue of debt settlement companies. The Attorney General's Office has been working with Representative Dabney and Ron Elwood and others on this issue, and the Office of the Minnesota Attorney General supports this bill. Now, many consumers are dealing with tough economic times, and they turn to these debt settlement companies for help. But there are problems. Consumers are often charged stiff upfront fees, but are often given no services in return for those upfront fees. Consumers are advised to stop paying their creditors, but then not told that they may incur fees, late charges, interest, and may be sued by their creditors. In addition, consumers are often confused about whether the creditors are paying their, whether the creditors are being paid by the debt settlement companies. And with that confusion, more problems arise. This bill provides many common sense protections for consumers. As Mr. Elwood mentioned, it requires a written signed contract. It has a cap on fees. And it's required disclosures and warnings, such as the pitfalls of stopping payment to your creditors, that fees and interest may accrue and you may be sued in court. It also provides for comprehensive enforcement. As Mr. Elwood mentioned, debt settlement companies would be required to register with the Department of Commerce, and the Department of Commerce would have investigatory powers on that registration. In addition, there are private enforcement rights, and in addition, public enforcement rights by the Office of the Attorney General. So in sum, the Attorney General's Office supports this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there any opposition to this bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Downey.
Thank you. While our colleagues from the debt settlement industry are coming down, I chose not to flood the members' packet with letters of support, but I did want to make it clear that we do have the support of the Minnesota Bankers Association, the Independent Community Bankers Association, the Minnesota Credit Union Network, U.S. Bank, Legal Aid, and Lutheran Social Services, as well as the Attorney General's Office.
Okay, thank you. And the opponents, would you state your name and go ahead and present?
Yes, I'm Dan Campbell. I represent the United States Organization for Bankruptcy Alternatives.
And I'm Kelly Seaman, and I also represent the United States Organization for Bankruptcy Alternatives.
Okay. Whoever wants to go first.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on House Bill 549. My name is Kelly Seaman. I'm speaking on behalf of the United States Organization for Bankruptcy Alternatives, which is a trade organization. I would like to offer our appreciation to Representative Dabney, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and the Alliance for being so willing to work with us on changes that would allow reputable debt settlement companies to provide services to Minnesota consumers while observing the utmost in consumer protection. We have made a commitment to working toward changes in the bill that would prevent House Bill 549 from banning our services, and we have been able to resolve several of those concerns. We believe this bill has the potential to become a model act for other states looking to regulate the debt settlement industry, and look forward to putting our organization on the list of bill supporters.
Thank you. Mr. Chair,
members, Dan Campo. Just a few minutes ago, we have been working with various groups on the language that will allow our clients to continue to work in Minnesota, and we're hoping and looking forward to supporting the bill, and we think we're very, very close. So we wanted to actually thank the chief author for working with us.
Thank you. Members, are there any questions? Okay, then Representative Johnson renews his motion to pass House File 549 as amended, and we've cleared it up. It goes to the General Register, we believe. So that'll be the motion. All in favor, say aye. All opposed, no. Carried.
Thank you, Chair and members.
Representative Simon, House File 890. Does somebody want to move House File 890?
I'll move.
Representative Jackson, Heather hand first. Representative Jackson moves House File 890. Where's the thing? Okay, we'll figure out. Representative Simon, do you know where it goes?
Yes, this will go to the General Register.
General Register, okay. Go ahead, Representative Simon, present your bill.
Thank you.
I believe you have also
an author's
amendment.
Yeah, and maybe if it pleases the committee, we could put that on first.
Okay. That's what I was just going to do. Representative Jackson, I assume you move House File 890, the Amendment A1.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carrie, go ahead, Representative Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for your time. I know you have a lot of bills, and I'm standing between you and dinner, so I'm going to try to be quick. This bill is about assisted reproduction. And it's really just modernizing and clarifying the laws we already have on the books. This doesn't make it more or less prevalent, more or less likely, and this is a bill that has nothing to do whether you think assisted reproduction is good, bad, or otherwise. But it exists out there, and we want to make sure our laws reflect the circumstances where all the parties agree, where intended mother, intended father, and the so-called the carrier, the gestational carrier, they all agree on who's the mom and who's the dad, and where they all agree, we ought to be able to modernize and streamline the laws that we already have. So this is a bill that aims to simplify the process and gives all the people involved from standing before a court so that they can basically effectuate their intentions. I just want to talk very quickly in bullet point fashion about what the bill does and then turn it over to the real experts. Really, the bill does four things. First, it says that the same rules that now apply to paternity determinations will also apply to maternity determinations. Secondly, it says that courts may award custody based on agreements of the parties, an assisted reproduction agreement. Third, it says that there's a presumption of paternity if the parties expressly agree that there is in an assisted reproduction agreement. And then fourth and finally, it allows pre-birth orders of maternity or paternity. And to describe why that's important, I'd like to turn it over to the testifier, Steve Snyder, who practices law in this area, has had many cases in this area, and will explain to you the rationale and why we need this.
Mr. Chair, if I might, in order to expedite this, if the testifiers could let us know what is different than last year's bill. I think last year's bill was vetoed, and I'm sure there was a veto letter, so as you're explaining to this, if you'd include whether or not you addressed governor's concerns or not, and what's different from last time around.
Well, Representative Holbrook, I'll ask them to include that, but I think they should explain the bill, because there's a lot of members of the committee that I remember the bill, but a lot of people are new this year, so.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, it is a different bill, but I'll have Mr. Snyder explain the bill in a little more detail and then go to exactly that point.
Mr. Snyder, go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Steve Snyder. I'm an attorney that's practiced assisted reproduction law for more than 20 years in Minnesota. I'm also the chair of the American Bar Association Reproductive and Genetic Technologies Committee, and I'm in communication with attorneys and other participants and professionals that work in this area on a nationwide and global basis. This bill is twofold. The primary purpose of this bill is to effect the fiscal savings and judicial economy in an atmosphere when the courts are already overloaded. Let me explain how it does that. Because the current laws were drafted before genetics were split in terms of creating parentage, before egg donors were possible, before surrogate pregnancies were possible, it has an archaic method of establishing parentage that presumes the genetic parents are the birth parents. A very common assisted reproductive technology procedure today is where a woman has had a total hysterectomy because of cancer or some other physiological problem, and her husband and she want to have a child. So they will have an anonymous egg donor, and they will have a woman who voluntarily agrees to carry the pregnancy. So what we have is we have a birth mother who is not the genetic mother and is not the intended mother. We have a woman who is not the genetic mother, but she's the intended mother, and everybody agrees that this is the outcome that they are trying to accomplish. In that situation, under current law, we have to go to court, we have to open a paternity file to establish the father's paternity. $300 and a court opening a file. We then have to open a voluntary termination of parental rights file to terminate the presumptive birth mother's rights, because under old law, if you gave birth, you were the mother. That is no longer the case under medical technology as it exists today. And then, so that's another $300 court filing fee and another clerk opening another file. Then we have to, in order to establish the parental rights of the non-genetically related intended mother,
go through an entire step-parent adoption process, another $300 filing fee, another clerk opening another file, and then we have to have three hearings in front of a judge that's already overloaded in a an environment where the budget has been cut and they are totally inundated with too much work and not enough time, where everybody is in agreement as to what the outcome is supposed to be. So all this bill does is it allows the judge, if all of the parties have signed a stipulation that says this is what we started and this is what we want, and they submit it to the judge with an affidavit that attests to the medical procedure, then the judge can enter a pre-birth order identifying the intended parents as the parents without the three court files being open, without the three hearings, and saving the court time and money and saving the parties time and money. I think it's a very fiscally prudent bill, and it facilitates the intent of the parties. Now, Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the difference in this bill between last year's bill and the veto letter is that we do not formally adopt or approve these procedures. We don't change the law respecting them at all. If there are contested procedures, the existing paternity law determines them, and that refers directly to best interest, which was one of the governor's biggest issues. It says nothing about the procedure as to permitting or facilitating compensation. The law is what the law is. We're not tampering with that. So the baby selling aspect that the governor also objected to is not tampered with by this bill. All we do is we add a presumption to the paternity statutes for these non-genetically related intended parents that allows the courts to use a simpler procedure to affect the intent of the parties in stipulated situations. And that's the purpose of the bill.
Mr. Chair, if I could add. Thank you. And just fundamentally, last year's bill had to do with what could be in or could not be in a contract of this kind. We're not doing that this year. This is a totally different kind of bill. We're saying we're not touching the rules that govern or don't govern the contract or the agreement. We're saying if there's an agreement, we're not touching the substance of it. We're modernizing our laws to reflect that there is an agreement. But unlike last year, we're not even touching the substance of the agreement. That's between the parties. We're not changing law. We're not disturbing it one bit. We got the message with the governor's veto. We're not here to get another veto. So, the other thing, Mr. Chair, that I just wanted to add before we go on to one other person is this is, you should have some materials in your packet. This is endorsed. There should be a letter in there from Resolve and from the Minnesota Bar Association Family Law Section. And I should point out that as with the bill last year, our understanding is that both MCCL and the Catholic Archdiocese are neutral on this bill. They've taken no position. So I just want folks to know that because I know that can be a sensitivity.
Thank you.
With that, we have
another. Simon, did you have another witness? Or?
We do.
Okay.
Is that okay? Do we have time, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead. We'll try to, hopefully, okay. Fairly short.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Stacey Seuss. My husband and I went through a surrogate to have a child 3 years ago. The process, both medically and legally, is extremely financially burdening to anybody. My thoughts on the whole process is that it was my egg. I'm the mom. However, when we went to the hospital to have the child, she was the mom because of the current law. After we had the baby, we had to go through yet another court case or another court time and more legal fees in order to have her parental rights relinquished so that I could be the mom on the birth certificate. So I guess I am obviously in support of this because I am the mom. It was my egg. Just because I had cancer and couldn't carry the child, we're kind of penalized with the current law.
Okay, thank you. Then Mr. Pritchard, I believe you wanted to testify on this. Go ahead, Mr. Pritchard.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and we have concerns about this bill as we did with the bill last year. First of all, I think you have to realize it's not going to be limited to just situations where you've got a real difficult situation, a person's got cancer, whatever, but this would be for all situations where whether you've got two biological parents who want to conceive but they can't, but this goes far beyond that. We view this as basically facilitating an incremental step in the direction of where they're trying to go last year, and we have concerns with that in terms of promoting and encouraging this activity of surrogacy, gestational activity. There's issues of compensation, and I think we're facilitating movement away from biological parents being the parents of their children, and I'm not sure that's in society's best interest to be doing that. And then finally, just quickly, it talks about, if you look on Section 4, it talks about facilitating these agreements and removing that the parties don't have to be present for the judge to issue their order, so are we cutting out people's right to have their voices heard? And also the notion that what is in the best interest of the child, is the child interest in this represented in this process, this procedure? It says here you can do away with the appointment of a guardian ad litem. So we feel that the child who's the result of this contract and being transferred doesn't have representation in a sense. And where is that child's best interest? Our whole concern with this whole process is it's kind of the commodification of children. Transfer of financial resources between two individuals and the child's part of the agreement. And we just think that's a step that we should not be moving in society and encouraging, promoting. So with those concerns, we just state our opposition to even the incremental effort to move in the direction of facilitating these agreements. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Is there anybody else that wanted to testify in this? Okay, are there any questions from any of the members? Okay, seeing none, Representative Jackson renews her motion to pass House File 890 as amended, and it goes to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries. And Representative Jackson moves the minutes of the March 4th, 9th, and 11th minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Series, and we are now adjourned.